So, welcome back to another episode of In a Perfect World. And it's not looking very perfect out there at the moment, I must say. This is early October 2017, and the shit is hitting the fan. And as I was just saying to my guest, hopefully that means some roses are starting to grow. But I think we're all starting to feel this massive pressure of transformation and the shadow coming up in the world. Anyway, we might get to that. I am very pleased to have on In a Perfect World today my good friend Tricia Eastman. Tricia, say hi.
Hi, everybody. And Rath, thank you so much. I can't tell you how honored I am to be on your show. I think there's a little shamanic magic in the way that you do this work, and excited to see what roads we go down today.
Well, it's funny you say that, Tricia, because each episode of In a Perfect World is actually a ceremony. And so these preamble things, this is the container that we're setting. This is blessing the sacred space. Thank you to the listeners. Thank you to you for coming to share your wisdom. Let's get juicy. So, Tricia, you're working in the psychedelic and the shamanic field. You're a facilitator and a retreat organizer you're working with Iboga. You've worked with 5-MeO-DMT. I remember when I was in LA over this summer, we were both featured on KTLA TV talking about ayahuasca and its popularity in America as well as in the West in general. You're actually a really cutting edge thought leader in this psychedelic renaissance. So what have you got for us?
Wow, well, that's quite an introduction. You know, I think right now we are going into a phase where, you know, the psychedelic renaissance is here. There's no denying it. There's no suppressing it. And now I see even more so people being called to be of service in this realm. Yet there's still being so much to learn and important information to disseminate to the public, to create a safe space for us to be in community with this work and in integrity. So I see even more so what's coming forward is structures to be able to allow people to have the freedom to work with different medicines, to, you know, have a neo-shamanic practice that incorporates even other modalities such as, you know, float tank therapy or meditation or kundalini yoga, and really like having a deeper understanding of how these things merge together in a symbiotic relationship.
Beautifully put. So, you know, that's the broad strokes. And the thing is, nitty gritty, basically when modalities or isms, I guess, start to percolate into a culture, there are these teething issues and these growth phases. If you look at things like, you know, meditation styles or martial arts, as they come into a culture and they're, you know, integrated, they happen and they create little shifts, you know, little hiccups and little sort of shifts along as people start to think differently, you know, to take on, say, a meditation practice, like it's something we have within us, but it actually means you've got to actually shift gears. And most of Western culture, pretty much, I guess, since the Industrial Revolution, has been all about the work culture, the 9-to-5. And, you know, before that, it was like 12-hour working days. And still, if we're really honest, it could still be about 12-hour working days. And, you know, the drugs or the consciousness agents which fuel and support the cultural paradigm, which has been work, 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 and really consume, consume, consume. And as capitalism has done, it's built an empire. It's had a lot of, you know, technological improvements all over the world. But in terms of the social improvements or the ability for people to connect with each other and to be in a heart-based level or to be sustainable as a planetary culture, it's failing, isn't it?
Yeah, I do feel that there are little pockets of people that are really growing and really creating integrated models for being in community. And I love what you talk about, this global village concept, of the idea of us bringing in the aspects of tribal culture, the important aspects of shamanism that basically fill that void of that disconnect that we have in modern day culture. And I feel that the medicines, they want to be used in the way that harmonious with modern day culture, they want to also be upgraded. And so I feel that, you know, there are this big tension point that wants to come to the surface. And it definitely is creating some tension and some disconnect in the shamanic community, in the spiritual communities I'm even seeing, such as, you know, the different Eastern type modalities of spiritual discovery. And it's not that we're arguing one is one way and one path is something else. It's like, how can we get it all to communicate and play with each other? So it's this idea of going from being a domesticated human, because when we were brought into these cities with all the busyness that happens, it's just too much information for a human who in the past, you know, lived in the jungle, like if you go back to our roots, to receive all that information. And so we shut off some of our faculties. And I mean, there was other things, you know, that also occurred that caused these faculties to get shut off, mainly the disconnection from our hearts is what created that. And, you know, ancestral trauma that actually does get healed, studies show, from living in a tribal or community environment. So what's happened is we're basically integrating back into being our, I call it sacred human. It's the human that's completely connected, heart connected, turned on. Studies have shown that we are naturally intuitive beings. And we do have these connections. And what the medicines do is they connect us to our natural ability inside, which is that we have this wisdom that exists within us that we all have. And we're just through these medicines and through these reemergence of modalities such as yoga becoming popular again in Western culture, or I shouldn't say again, becoming popular in Western culture. What's happening is we're learning again how to feel, and it's okay to feel. And we're learning to work with our shadow, and we're learning that there's value in our shadow. And we're also learning that we have this vast creative potential when we tap into these resources. And it's the hard part, I would say, in this integration piece is going from being a disconnected being that's not getting a lot of information outside of just the basic, you know, kind of third dimensional senses, to go into a fully activated being that's connected to their intuition, that's connected to their heart, that's fully present in their body. And so within that, we have a lot of different types of offerings related to the world of, you know, waking up into that part of yourself and remembering that part of yourself. And I feel like it's really hard when you haven't really, when you don't really have access to that information to make the right choices in terms of how to reconnect to those parts of yourself. So it's really important that we're in this process spreading that information out so that people, as they are starting to learn, have the right educational tools to help shepherd them onto the path that is for their highest good in returning to their sacred human self.
Yeah, I was just having this same conversation with my friend Cherie. Big hi to Cherie, a regular listener to the show, about this idea that what we do, you know, in this world, like putting information out about the shamanic world or the medicines or right relationship and being, I guess, you know, commentators and trying to help steer and nurture the culture, it doesn't always pay, but it is, there's a higher calling and there's a higher reason for it. And we're all sort of like mimetic spores that help switch on the others, and it helps the information flow and it helps the medicine flow. But I really valued everything you just said. And I'm just wondering though, I remember, like, you know, 11 years ago when I first went down to the Amazon, and there was this whole idea at the time, and that was sort of that first peak of ayahuasca in Western culture National Geographic magazine had just covered it. It was sort of this watershed event. And there was this whole meme that was like, ayahuasca is a vine and she just wants to reach out and embrace the world. And it's a potent metaphor, and I think it's true, and I think it's still valid. But what's been happening, just to use the example of ayahuasca, which is one of the predominant entheogens that's helped fuel this shamanic renaissance around the world, is that as she reaches out into the world, she does so through the cultural circuit board, which basically is capitalist, consumerist. And do you feel that the medicines are in danger of being commodified? Do you feel that, you know, there's a, maybe things like ayahuasca and iboga and even 5-MeO-DMT and the toad medicine, as they come in, they have to do so through a transmission point of the medicine holders. Now, in indigenous cultures, those medicine holders already have probably the tribal structure that supports them to be the medicine holders. In our culture, we don't. So we have to have a foot in two worlds, and it means that we have to figure out what works for us ethically and sustainably in our relationship with money and our relationship with medicine. So what do you feel about that?
So I think that, you know, there are different levels of, you know, depth of the work depending on where the individual is in their life. For instance, right now, you know, we're walking into, you know, in the next couple years, having psychedelic assisted therapy with MDMA be legal. And with that becoming legal for treatment of like PTSD and other potential disorders, right now it's just, you know, being tested for the PTSD. What that particular way of working with medicine has to be systematized. But the reason being is to really, you know, gather the data to be able to prove that it's safe, number one. But also I feel that when someone has such a high level of trauma, they are less likely to surrender. And the big secret in these shamanic experiences is the idea of surrender. So right now it is legal to do ketamine therapy for in the US with a doctor for depression. So I do feel in that respect those medicines are essential as a bridge to moving into a more shamanic practice with, let's say, ayahuasca or mushrooms,
you know what?
Iboga.
I haven't really formalized this thought before, but I've always respected organizations like MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, for pioneering and bringing, you know, back the valuable tools of psychedelics into the medical fold. But I wonder, and I've always had this sort of like, you know, dichotomy between this, there seems to me to be a difference potentially in the usage or the potential of psychedelics and of the shamanic entheogens. And maybe it's set and setting and maybe it's the way they're utilized. But for instance, you know, MDMA for PTSD, wonderful, really great. Where does the PTSD come from? I mean, if we go to the root cause of these things, it's the society and the culture in general, which is set up to systematically run down, erode, disconnect, and, you know, keep them little commodified battery farm units of human consciousness. And I wonder if there's this danger of the soma of the masses. And you see dystopian films like The Hunger Games, where, you know, they give us a little glimpse of potential pathways of the future where it's like, all right, so things are collapsing. Let's let go of the countryside. Let's put the domes up. Let's keep the cities. Let's make everything legal, like all the drugs legal, because you need a social release valve. I mean, I said at the start, it's like the Victorian era work ethic, you know, alcohol and tobacco and things which would fuel that work ethic were what was rewarded by the culture. The culture is rapidly changing, and they're noticing, they're calling it, you know, late stage capitalism or cannibal capitalism, or the fact that, you know, the system has to change because the world's changing, the environment's changing, it's collapsing. And so then the permissibility of what they allow in is changing as well. And I wonder if it's this social release valve where everything is permissible as long as you keep the system the same as it tries to adapt to the change. So, you know, the PTSD, if you get the war vets on the PTSD and they do the MDMA therapy and they're clearing a lot of stuff, but then they're plugged back into the Matrix battery farm culture, it's just a band-aid on, you know, what is the treadmill of the cultural expectations. Whereas, for instance, the shamanic medicines, if you take something like ayahuasca and you're only using it to alleviate late-stage cancer, terminal illness, anxiety, or with the psilocybin mushrooms they're doing, you're really reducing down the full spectrum of the spiritual experience and the reconnection to the Gaian mainframe down to this medicalization model they're trying to pigeonhole the entheogens into, like they're trying to do with the psychedelics. And I wonder, really good people are working on this, and I applaud everything they're doing. It's not them I'm questioning. I'm questioning the cultural agenda behind the medicalization of these substances.
Yes. So I want to say I agree 100% with everything that you're saying. And just to add to that, you know, I think there is a certain point at which people are ready to work with ayahuasca. There is a certain point at which, you know, when people are ready, the timing is perfect for them to work with 5-MeO-DMT from Bufo alvarius, as well as Iboga. Iboga probably being one of the most powerful of them all. It's not necessarily the best thing to give people right out the gate. It can actually be traumatizing to the person, depending on the facilitation technique. So what I would say is, just to add to that, that if you take someone who's classified with narcissistic personality disorder, which, you know, I don't know, there's probably quite a few people in the US that have that, namely maybe one that's in charge of our country, and you give them, you know, a really high powered psychedelic such as DMT, they are going to have so much invested in their reality being the third dimensional, whatever the reality is that they know, that they can just kind of deny the experience altogether, or just have, you know, PTSD from the experience being too intense for them. The thing I like about MDMA is it decreases the blood flow in the amygdala, which is the animal brain, or the reptilian brain, sorry, and it increases blood flow in the frontal lobe. So you can take someone into their trauma and they can process it from their higher mind, which is, you know, out of that fight or flight that they've been in for so long. Once you start to like open that doorway where they're not gripping on so much, then there's room to bring in other things like ayahuasca and, you know, maybe 5-MeO-DMT or POT or Iboga, you know, but I don't think everyone is suited to just right out the gate, go right into plant medicine. The other reason why, and I mean, ultimately, like on a spiritual level, these were designed for us. These are our gifts to help us in our remembering. So yes, everyone is designed to have these things. So I will also say that, but I also want to add to that, that, we have such a long history of stigma around use of medicines that has been ingrained into the religious culture. And so with that also being said, to bring someone into their shadow, you know, they see these devils and entities and darkness and they think, oh my God, it's satanic. I need to stay away from that. When it's actually their own darkness in themselves that they're not willing to address yet. So I think it's beautiful because the MDMA is the heart medicine. It's like opening up the heart, connecting to the heart. And once you start to get that heart channel open, then it makes it easy to walk through the doorway into these other experiences, really looking at the shadow, really looking at, you know, these other aspects. And in the process of development, like I actually built kind of like a tree of life of the psychedelic medicines. And I was like, okay, so this is a good one to start with. And it's not necessarily like a one size fits all thing, but I definitely do believe there are certain medicines that work really well. For instance, I find when Thai person carries a lot more trauma from the father's side of the family, that they do really well with the masculine medicines such as iboga, peyote. When someone has more related to the feminine trauma, then they tend to do really well with ayahuasca or mushrooms, the tryptamine family. So one is working on the serotonin system, and the other one is working more on the dopamine system. And I say this in a very simplified term because it's definitely more complicated and sophisticated than that. But I do think there is a really integrated pathway. And at the same time, I think, yes, if we can create a structure where we can get communities together and be serving maybe in a church format, ayahuasca, I think it could be healing for everybody, for sure.
Well, I remember in the ayahuasca test they did back in the 90s, the Ayahuasca Project with Dennis McKenna and Eduardo Luna, the findings were not just that ayahuasca did, you know, improve the serotonin receptors or the sort of neuroplasticity of the brain or improving the mood. It was just the fact they were members of the Santo Daime Church and they had a community which supported them in the integration afterwards and to maintain their sense of well-being and how they went forward in the world. So yet again, I really like your answers, Tricia. Very, very knowledgeable. I like this idea that, you know, I've had this as well, that basically, you know, it comes down to your map of consciousness and your map of multidimensionality and how the plant entheogens or the psychedelics being man-made. And ultimately, everything is nature. And, you know, it's sort of like, as you're saying, this surrender. It's almost this intellectual surrender to the fact that there's a bigger force at work. And it's the force of nature as it permeates into the astral, into the energetic, you know, higher dimensions. And the fact there's rhythms and there's seasons and there's a flow to all of this. And so the fact that, you know, the shamanic medicines are coming back at this time, at the same time as there's been this cultural disconnect for a generation or two with the psychedelics as that tried to push through back in the 60s, it's like that there's stepping stones. And you're right, it's like these things are available potentially to everyone because with the entheogens, at least, Mother Gaia secretes them. I mean, she makes them, and she makes them as, you know, Terence McKenna had this idea of exopheromones and interspecies communication and modulation. So it allows us to open up to, I guess, what Aldous Huxley called the mind at large and receive larger yes. transmissions of information, which are there. It's just that we've been so filtered in a narrow bandwidth because of the cultural survival mechanism. And that's what history is. History has basically been, I think, a cultural survival mechanism from the shock and the trauma of the disconnect of unity consciousness 10,000 or more years ago when something went down, when the fall happened. But, you know, the psychedelics are good. And I had this whole little riff that was in my original Aya book about, you know, in the 60s, acid opened the mind. In the 80s, ecstasy opened the heart. And in the north, mm-hmm. the plant medicines are helping, you know, reopen and tune in the soul. And they're sort of like stepping stones. But to understand stepping stones, you have to have an idea of the bigger picture and the gradation and the fact that it doesn't end at the medicalization. And the medicalization is almost the training wheels. I mean, you know, there's a difference yeah. between doctors and there's a difference between priests and there's a difference between maybe mystics or whatever. And all of those words are really loaded because in our culture, in some ways, all of those roles have been debased. And as we know, the shamanic figure in more indigenous societies plays all of those roles and more, the traveler between the worlds and the healer and the trickster and the doctor and the priest, because, you know, it wasn't meant to be just broken down because holistically health and well-being have a multifaceted, reality to them. And so does consciousness and so does well-being and so does the psychedelic, entheogenic, shamanic experience.
Exactly. And I feel that this is something that
this is something which is coming back into our culture really now. And this is the thing I really like. Until you see that there's a higher dimensional force, it's like we're on the beach and we're seeing waves come in, but we're not understanding that there's a deep ocean creating the waves, or we just haven't got the right end of the stick. You know, it's really when you have the deeper, you know, entheogenic reality tearing back the veil experiences where you experience multidimensionality and it puts in context where our place is in the universe. And, you know, sometimes I've had these 5-MeO experiences where I realize the center is everywhere. It's incredible and it's beautiful and it's a unified field of being, but it really changes the worldview.
Yeah, so what I have experienced myself personally, and I think this is something that in one of the medicines that I work with is Iboga, and it's a long path of study. In order to serve Iboga, you're looking at, you know, anywhere from 10 years, maybe more. And it's not like you just say, okay, I'm going to go study this for 10 years and then you get to serve medicine. It's whenever the Nima, which is the shaman, says you've healed yourself and you're ready to hold space for the medicine tells the Nima. And that's when you have permission from the medicine to serve medicine. And in that culture, like the big initiation, so the Bwiti live in Gabon in Africa, and in a harsh jungle where survival is much harder than in Western culture. You know, we're talking about getting bit by poisonous snakes and you know, deadly animals and many other things, bacterial, you know, things, malaria. And in that culture, a boy at age 14 goes through an initiation through a rite of passage. And in that rite of passage, he meets his soul. He connects and receives all the answers to the bigger picture, that same story that you were just telling me about the 5-MeO-DMT. He has that experience within himself. And once he has that peace, he's able to go about living his life with that understanding of how, what role he plays in the bigger scheme of things. And we have taken that out of our culture. You know, in Western culture, we don't have a rite of passage. And I feel that every person needs to see that within themselves in order for them to actually be able to fully operate from that space, away from the trauma,
This is what we're going through. I mean, there's many different phrases we all create and little memes, but essentially, it's like a planetary initiation, because there's been 10,000 years of history, which has been an energetic blockage, and you can't create or destroy energy. It just builds up, and it's got to express somewhere, and it's coming through now. But, you know, we have... Yeah, again, it's like tribal societies, not to say that they're these utopian, you know, noble, savage ideals, but in general, despite the adversity of living and a survival, there's that that support mechanism of other humans and the idea of the right transmission of initiation and of energy and of the tangibility of relationship to the earth. And this is what we've really lost. We've gone from probably caves to towns to cities, and each of them in a sense, compartmentalizing ourselves away from nature to protect ourselves from nature, and we've lost this sense of initiation. So it's really coming back with a vengeance now, and I think we're all facing it.
Absolutely. And I also see that this initiation is really that, from my experience in those spaces of 5-MeO-DMT or in the space with Iboga, in the dreamtime state, so they call it, I have seen this, the beginning of time to the end of time and the evolution of culture. And as I was being shown this, I realized that we had to go through what we did in order to get to where we are now and where we're headed. And where we're headed is a beautiful place if we all choose to create that together. And I love that the name of your podcast is A Perfect World, because in those visions, I saw the perfect world. And to me, that gave me the biggest vision to be able to dedicate myself towards helping the upliftment and being a beneficial presence on the planet to help get to that place as a collective. And I do feel really clearly that we have the tools with these medicines to do this. The main issue that we have right now And it's basically, in order to become a global tribal culture, there has to be a fundamental shift in leadership. Not who's leading the planet, but how people are leading the planet.
Yeah, it has to be networks, not hierarchies. It has to be consensus. It has to be agreement. It has to be everyone, like true democracy without the bullshit phrases of the isms of democracy. Just people communicating with people, you know, it's time.
Yeah. And so even if we do heal the trauma, even if we do heal all of these other pieces, we still have to also address the leadership. And the leadership is really about this idea of collective facilitation and the idea of you know, holding space, you know, holding collective space for each other and collective collaboration. And it really is the main number one thing is surrender in all of that, because in order to be willing to allow that to take place, you have to truly trust that the order of all of this in the bigger scheme of things is safe and benevolent.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
And this is where I know a lot of people, you know, intellectually think it's just hippie new age woo-woo. And I can understand that, because that comes from a place of intellect and survival and baseline consciousness and 9 to 5, where in that reality you have to go from A, B, C, D all the way through. You know, and it doesn't sort of appreciate the higher dimensionality, the interconnectedness, the fact that there's a larger force orchestrating everything that we are manifestations of. And, you know, it's like it doesn't have that vantage point. So it's hard for that baseline consciousness to trust. And, you know, I fall back into that all the time as well. I think we all do. But it's this ultimate lesson that I've understood that the ceremony never ends. Once you've really had that veil pulled back, you know it's there. It's like pulsing. It's just one, you know, iota of consciousness away. It's that groove you just need to slip into, that the way to see the world. And it's waiting and it's nurturing and it's working through us. And the surrender is continual. And I will say it is very difficult in the baseline. Well, when you're out of the container of I've gone off to do a ceremony but come back into the world to integrate, and what do I do with what I've experienced, to continue that idea of surrender and of service and of highest good while surviving the battery farm of modern world.
Absolutely. And what's interesting is that this new way of being in the world, of allowing, you know, allowing your experience, is becoming incredibly popular. Authors such as Stephen Kotler and Jamie Wheel wrote this book called Stealing Fire. That's all about this idea of getting in these states of ecstasis, and that in those states of ecstasis, we naturally drop into flow. And the flow state is that state of being in complete surrender, being in complete synchronicity. It's that thing that they talk about when you go to Burning Man and you're on that wild adventure. And it's something that all can achieve and all live in. It's just really the trauma, the undigested energies that, you know, that we haven't really looked at within ourselves, that are blocking that abundance, that divine inheritance that is available to all of us.
So, Tricia, you're a very wise woman, and I'm really enjoying this conversation. Let me pivot and turn at this point in our conversation and ask, how did you get to be who you are? Like, how did this happen? I mean, we all come from the mainstream, or, you know, in the Western world, we're born in the suburbs, we're living this this reality tunnel that we don't know is a reality tunnel. But how did you take your first steps onto the medicine path?
It's really interesting because I grew up in a very Christian family, so I carried, you know, a lot of shame. Like, I had been programmed that psychedelics are bad, and this was the work, you know, it was harmful to oneself. And As I became, you know, of age to leave the home, I discovered MDMA actually at through the, you know, the rave scene, through the dance scene. And I found, like, I finally found my tribe, like my group of people that it would, it just felt like, wow, everything fits. It's like Goldilocks, just right. And I worked for this store, and it was a Pulp Fiction bookstore, but they also had a counterculture bookstore called Raver Books. And they sold all the books from like Terence McKenna, Ram Dass.
You know, I used to work in a bookshop in London many lifetimes ago, and I ran the counterculture bookshop, and it was right at the Terence McKenna peak as well. So funny.
Oh my God, it's such a small world. So yeah, so I started to kind of dabble in getting to know about these different, you know, psychedelic experiences, and I was still terrified. You know, I remember when I did MDMA, the first time I was like, please don't break me. Please don't break me. You know, I was like thinking that in my mind, but I took the medicine knowing, you know, that it would be healing for me. And, later down the line, you know, there was a lot of press around, these drugs being harmful, or calling them drugs even. And yeah,
you just called it MDMA a medicine. I know nowadays we're thinking of it that way, but back then, were you thinking of it as a medicine, or were you thinking, we use this term ecstasis, which I really like as well from the Greek, the ecstasy, but it's like the connection with the divine. That's true ecstasy. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with recreation that leads to ecstasis, because that has been, you know, suppressed in our culture. And so it's what you do with it. But were you thinking of it as a medicine back then, or just like this is a pathway and a revelation?
I mean, I was thinking of it as, you know, something to have fun and, you know, just have a release and have a good time. And I, you know, read stories about like things like them. It's saying it eats holes in the brain. And I'm thinking, oh, that's not good. I don't want to have that happen to me. So I stopped taking them. And many years passed. I had managed to build a very successful life for myself. I was married. I had 4 houses. I had a business with 13 locations. I had everything that the American dream, I was the American dream poster child, let's just say. And I wasn't happy. And so I started drinking. I started developing anxiety, like massive anxiety. Went to the doctors. Of course, they prescribed me with Xanax. So I started taking Xanax. So I was doing 2 glasses of wine at night, taking Xanax. And then finally, I got reintroduced to MDMA again after, like, you know, not taking it for probably about 6 or 7 years. And I started taking it again. And I had what you would call, you know, in the mystical traditions, a Kundalini awakening experience. Mm. And in that experience, I saw a vision of what I was supposed to do. And literally, it was like an angelic presence had come down and told me, you know, this is, you know, you're not, you, this is the path that is your highest truth. And so I made the decision to divorce my husband, to give all my houses to him. And I walked away with just $45,000 in cash, which is a nice amount of money to walk away with. But I in this vision, like, I knew I needed to receive insights into what was next for me. And I had no idea how I was going to be of service, you know, like what I was going to do. I just knew that what I was doing in the past wasn't working. So, and I was so desperate for like relief from the suffering that I was experiencing. I remember going and seeing a therapist, and the therapist said to me, you know, you're just like a breed of Chihuahua. You know how Chihuahuas shake all the time? Mm-hmm. Like that I would just be anxious like that. And mm-hmm. then another psychotherapist told me, you know, you're always going to have an uninvited guest at the party, Mr. Anxiety. And he would do these exercises with me where he put anxiety in the corner and being like, you suck, and all these things. Like, it was like this voice in my head. And I literally was like, this is what I have to do for the rest of my life is be in these silly psychotherapy sessions and suffer like this all the time and pop Xanax and all these things. And so I was willing to let go of anything. I was desperate. So I walked away from all my things. And at the same time, a year prior to that, I read this book called Plant Spirit Medicine. And it talked about ayahuasca. And I knew I was interested. I was called to it. This was back in like 2011. But I had no idea where to find it. I was thinking I had to go to the jungle. Well, after I had done my stint in Europe, I traveled for about 4 months. I was very strongly guided. Like I felt like it was like a divine guidance to move to Los Angeles. So, I mean, of all places, I would think I would be divinely guided to. I don't know. It just seemed kind of strange. But I listened and I moved to Los Angeles. And almost immediately upon arriving, I found a connection to ayahuasca. And I spent several years working with the medicine and had some really profound results. However, I still hadn't gotten to the core of some of the major issues that like literally were like governing my being, and that included severe eating disorders. And so
is it that ayahuasca, I mean, why do you think that is? Because some people can, is it the surrender? Is it there's like deeper and deeper chambers of surrender that even ayahuasca has to gradiate and slowly peel away? Or what was the resistance?
I think I'm a Scorpio. I feel like I can hold on to things. Like I'm really good at like holding on to certain things. Like I can either totally surrender or I can really hold on to something. And so I think that was just like a part of myself that I just wasn't willing to fully love and accept. And I met this doctor in Mexico and we started talking about he had a clinic in Tijuana where they work with a medicine called iboga in the form of ibogaine, which is the extracts, the alkaloids from the iboga, mm-hmm. and they use it for treatment addiction for heroin. And I'm like, I wonder if this would work for eating disorders. So we kind of made a deal and I was doing some writing, and I said, I'd love to write a story about this and be kind of like a guinea pig to see if this would really, you know, work for me. And so I went down and I did it, and it was profound. It was the first time I've ever in my life fully accepted every single part of myself and loved every single part of myself. And that created a huge shift in my life. And I knew I wanted to be of service.
What was that like, the ibogaine experience? I mean, there's different, it's an extract from the iboga plant or the wood. Is it experientially, it's probably the only major entheogen I haven't done yet. I'm looking forward to it the more I hear about it. But how would you describe the experience? What happened to you experientially?
Well, I feel like the iboga spirit, the first thing it does is it really puts you in your body. In the sense that, you know, if you try to distract yourself with other things, the medicine will create, for instance, let's say you're trying to listen to outside conversation rather than being focused on what you're dealing with inside with the medicine, then it would create like buzzing in your ears so loud that you have no other choice but to, you know, go inward. So it really drives you inwards to face all those things that, you know, we spend so much of our time. I mean, that's what addiction is, running away from these things. And once I had been through that aspect of the journey of really clearing through and looking at kind of a life review of my life, then I was really shown the nature of the universe. I was shown the entire galaxy and the connection to the planet Earth. And I was shown the cycle of the beginning of time to the end of time, down to the point at which singularity happens. And it basically, the way I would describe it is when the light is birthed from the void. And when I realized that it wasn't about the light, that the darkness was there before the light, I realized that my orientation was all wrong, and I just started bursting into tears, and I just had gratitude for everything.
So what do you mean about the void? I mean, I you know, you hear this a lot, the void, and sometimes with 5-MeO, a lot of people go to the light, but there's also a very statistical amount of people that go to the darkness or the void behind the light or somehow related to the light. What do you think about the darkness or the void, the dark void?
So I think of the void as the point of creation and the point of destruction. It's the center of everything, in a sense, because it's basically this place that is, I would call it the womb of the universe. So it's this place where all things begin, and many people travel to that place and become very scared. And I think the hardest thing, I think, in all psychedelic experiences is when you don't realize that you're the one responsible for being the light. You're the light. Everything else around you is just a reflection of your inner environment. But it's you that has to cultivate the love. It's you that has to cultivate the life. And you're fully responsible by being co-creative with the universe, by choosing with your will, with your own fire, to focus on your heart.
Beautiful. So what was the outcome of that experience then? How did you integrate that into your life?
So, I mean, the first thing was that I asked the medicine, how can I be of service? And I said, you know, bring me these opportunities to be of service. So within a very short period of time, I was asked by the clinic to start facilitating. And I had a background in training in healing modalities and studied mystery school and was the person at, you know, back in the day when I was working for Raver Books, who was like, before the Zendo Project existed, I was the person taking care of people having rough experiences. Yep. So I it wasn't a leap for me to do that, but I still paused and I was like, well, that's kind of a big responsibility. You know, I'm not a shaman. And when I meditated on it, it felt really clear that it wasn't about that. It was more about really just going into it and taking it step by step and not making it something in my mind. And so I said yes. And I mean, the rest is history. I've been working now with the 5-MeO-DMT is the medicine that I have the strongest relationship with. And I would call myself like that, me and that medicine are, you know, like best friends. And I feel like, you know, there's a certain level of experience and training to where you can say that you really are a carrier of that medicine. I'm a carrier of that medicine. And, the Iboga, on the other hand, which also I worked with at the clinic, you know, again, it's a long road of training. And so I've gone through initiations with Nimas and with other, you know, training, working, and also organizing retreats where I bring together really amazing, beautiful Iboga facilitators and Nimas. And also, you know, and part of that facilitation and integration process and do them in beautiful places like Costa Rica, where the medicine is legal, at least for, you know, shamanic purposes.
So you had your experience with Ibogaine, and that was sounding like a very deep, you know, intergalactic initiation. What was then your first experience with 5-MeO-DMT?
Beautiful. So after I worked with the Iboga, my first experience with the Iboga medicine, I was also offered a session to work with the 5-MeO-DMT from the Bufo Alvarius. And in the first time in my entire life, I felt my mind disappear. I felt all the pain and suffering in me disappear. And I felt that interconnection with all life, all existence. But there was no one else there. It was just one divine presence. And in that space, I could also see, as I was starting to become reassembled, as my soul was, or myself was being reassembled back into Trisha, I was seeing all of the different archetypal energies of the people in my life, and I saw them as geometries, and I had a deep understanding of how all these different pieces dance together and how they work together. And it was so interesting to me that I could receive all that information just through a transmission. Within a matter of minutes, I had a complete understanding of something so big, it's beyond articulation with language.
Yeah, it's very challenging. So, you know, we talked a little bit about the start about these stepping stones and the ideas of the psychedelics in a medical set and setting, helping clear trauma, and then plant entheogens and earth medicines like the toad being deeper levels of initiation, I guess. It sort of brings us a bit full circle. It's like there's, you know, you're doing iboga retreats in Costa Rica, working with 5-MeO-DMT. There's this palette of entheogens that are out there, and they all have different stages of initiation. Where do you think this is going in terms of how we integrate these things into Western culture?
Well, I feel that what needs to happen is a new level of organization. And that organization isn't about policing anything. It's about guardianship. It's about guardianship of these important containers that are tried and tested. One of the biggest conflicts I see happening in the world of shamanic culture is different tribes having a way of how they do things, and also feeling that the Western culture is dishonoring that. And what I find is that when you look at like the way the Lakota Sioux do a teepee ceremony with peyote, that there's a very specific reason that the doorway faced the east. And there's a very specific reason why you only go to the left side when you enter the teepee and go around the fire only in that direction. All of these things are important for these aspects of ceremony, and they represent something. So I feel that there are interpretations that if we can get all this information together collectively and interpret it and be able to create a guardianship of education to educate people on the why and why it's important to build a relationship with some of these medicines before you would decide to give them to another person, for instance. But I do think that there is a way of disseminating that information that is for the highest good of everyone. I had a recent issue where there was a retreat that I saw planned, and a lot of people were asking me about it from another person in the medicine community. And I felt that some of the practices were unsafe medically. And I asked the medicine, like I did a little microdose of toad, and I went in and I asked the medicine, you know, what should I do about this? And it said, don't interfere. And I was like, okay. So I realized that it's not our job to necessarily intercede. I think councils are very useful, especially if medicine facilitators are crossing boundaries, and you know, just to let them know that the community is watching and that it is important that, you know, that they, you know, receive the attention and the healing, which can be done in a tribal way, you know, in these councils, to be able to protect people receiving medicine. So I think that this idea of having a guardianship where we are merging these different neo-shamanic traditions together, and also teaching the best practices, and the best practices being the way that we were talking about just a second ago, leadership, leadership being flat. And so in the old days, it might have been, or in the past, it might have been that the shaman held a lot of power for the village and maybe was seen as like a, as a hero or as a guru or whatever you say. But that type of model for this work is no longer conducive to what we're creating as a collaborative community, collective, you know, shamanic culture. And so what is most conducive is to show people how to be that reflection to help people go deeper within themselves, to help them get those answers within themselves, to be able to hold space in a way where they're not taking any of that power, and to also provide the healing in that that setting so that those that are in those positions are able to hold that space and not be reacting out any of their trauma that would cause them to take that power for themselves.
Yeah, it's a dense and sort of complicated issue, but it is one of the most pressing ones I think we find ourselves in the West, in the shamanic community, because, you know, just to backtrack a bit there, if you take indigenous styles of working with medicines like ayahuasca and then with respect, you know, there's often criticism about cultural appropriation or, you know, not right usage or things like that. But as you say, there's reasons perhaps why ceremonies are structured in a certain way or medicines are used in a certain way. If we don't just blindly follow the dogmas, but if we deconstruct the why, what are the energetics? What is the relationship with the medicine? What does it want us to do in these modern times, in these modern contexts, but keeping, you know, perennial containers, I think we can reapply them. And then there's other issues about, I guess the community I'm most aligned with at the moment is the toad community globally, and working with that medicine and working with the community to navigate and to anchor and integrate the explosive growth of the toad medicine into the West. And, you know, it's basically the same vectors and growth relationships I saw in ayahuasca culture over the last decade happening in the last year, you know, but it's the same issues we face. It's like, you know, the right container, the right relationship, the right respect, screening, integration, best practices, all the same things you say, but there seems to be such a even more, if not urgency, just gravity to the situation, because the toad medicine is such a powerful entheogen and such a powerful remembrance of our own innate divine nature. That it can have a lot of fallout. Like, I mean, ayahuasca can have a lot of fallout, all the medicines can, and it's great to see the growth in the culture, especially around West Coast America, you know, of things like the AWARE Project and their sister organization with the Integration Project, and there's Erie up in San Francisco, there's a lot of integration circles and things like that. I think there's this needs to be more awareness and support from the community to other members of the community. And, you know, the difference perhaps between ayahuasca and toad medicine on one level is that many people who do ayahuasca become enamored with it and want to continue their practice. Not that many people, you know, statistically want to then work with ayahuasca, because as you said with iboga, it's a very high learning curve to do it properly, to work with the medicine properly. It requires a lot of dedication and sacrifice of dieters and training. To those people who want to go to that degree, with the toad medicine, there's this really weird inverse dynamic happening where essentially on just a baseline level, you have a pipe and you have the medicine and you can provide the medicine. It doesn't mean you're a shaman. It doesn't even mean you're a facilitator. I think Martin Ball, who has written a lot about 5-MeO, has broken down into some archetypal forms where he says there's a provider, there's, you know, a facilitator, and perhaps there's that shamanic role of working with energy more. But there's definitely different levels of both ability and of service that people can step up to in working with toad and with other medicines. But I think there's also this, if not glamour, there's this romanticization, or there's this need I recognize in myself, and I see it in you, and I see it in a lot of people, and it's very respectable of being in service and wanting to help. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the gravity and the responsibility of being a practitioner and looking after people, not just in the peak experience, but in their mental well-being and their physical well-being before and after these very, very big transformative experiences, it doesn't mean that everyone is suited to that role and that we can have different ways we can be of service. And I think one of the greatest ways we can all be of service is to support each other as a community, to not fall into division, to not fall into haters and naysayers and sort of flame wars, and to recognize that there are a diversity of styles, especially with something like toad medicine, which is coming back not just into the West, but coming back into the world, because it doesn't have an unbroken lineage. There seems to be a growing amount of anthropological, historical evidence of its use in Mesoamerica, but it doesn't necessarily have a set container. You know, there's ways which we need to listen to the medicine to teach us what is the best ways, and there's a multiplicity of ways. You know, there's the smaller doses or the micro doses, there's the full release doses, there's inside, there's outside. Yeah. But as long as there's a certain standard duty of care and best practices within that diversity, you know, and I think this is the challenge of the culture, is to listen to each other and to support each other in recognizing that we are all of service. But, you know, if something goes wrong, we're all going to feel that brunt of what goes wrong, because we are all connected and we are all one. And we need to not be so egoic and not so reactionary that we attack each other, but we support each other in saying, if you do it that way, that's great, but there's got to be some understanding of best practices within the diversity.
Absolutely. I mean, the biggest challenge that I've found related to these different levels of experience is that you don't know what you don't know. And I've seen so many people think, you know, hey, I'm going to go out there and train people. And then if you train people in a way that they think now they have a license to practice medicine, it leaves them in a space where there isn't room, less room, I should say, for their growth and development. But it also is misleading in the sense that they think that they can do something that they may not be fully able to do. There are some basic things that a person should have in place before they even think about holding space for medicine. And one of those things, which is really simple, is first aid training. Because when you have a person leaving their body, like that's basically what's happening on the 5-MeO, and they're in an altered state, if for some reason their air passage is blocked in any way, that can be a huge issue. You know, if you're not prepared to work with that situation. The other issue is if you have not had any background in trauma that comes up, if it's not addressed properly, can actually make a person, put someone in a state where they may not even be able to function in the world. Mm. It can, and so you have to be prepared to be able to understand when something comes up, how to navigate through that space. And so what I tell people is, you know, when they say, oh, I'm interested in serving medicine, I say, I'm not saying this means anything, because I try not to, like, I don't want to direct people into misinterpreting what I say in any way, because, you know, I want to be a guide for the highest truth. So when a person thinks about it, I say, go to Zendo Project, go to their website, watch their training videos online. They have a free manual. It's psychedelic first aid and harm reduction. Go watch all those. Then take the time, plan it out in your schedule, volunteer to be a volunteer for Zendo Project and see how that goes. See, you know, because you have to be prepared, if you are willing to hold medicine, that the most extreme potential worst case scenario could happen. Mm. Not that we're wanting that to happen, but you need to be prepared for that. So it's good to be in that space and see people that are having difficult psychedelic experiences to really know what responsibility you're holding, because you would be creating that for somebody by serving them that medicine if you're not prepared to hold that
space.
And, you
know, one of the best and easiest ways to minimize some of the more adverse reactions is to have an efficient screening process. So, you know more about the people who are coming to you for the medicine on a physical, medical, emotional level. So you can, you know, understand where they're coming from and prepare for that.
Absolutely. And with a medicine like this, like 5-MeO-DMT, for instance, or even Iboga, there are so many contraindications. And, you know, like there's a general rule of thumb I like to say with any pharmaceutical medications, you know, to, you know, take the half-life of the medication and multiply it by 6 to 8 times. But then, of course, there's other things that go within that, that, you know, it's not always that rule of thumb. So, and then the other thing you have to think about when you're talking to people in the intake that are on medications are when you tell somebody to go off of a MAOI, like an antidepressant, benzodiazepines, or Adderall, like any of those, you know, that fall in that category of like ADHD, ADD medications, they have severe withdrawal symptoms, and they're actually supposed to be done under medical supervision, and you're supposed to taper it down. There's a tapering down protocol, and it's very common for people to have severe suicidal thoughts, even if they're not suicidal. So if you have someone who's going through a really, you know, traumatic time in their life, where they're being called, maybe they're being called because of this, these issues that are coming up, and then you say, oh, well, you have to go off these medications, and that can even in itself affect the, you know, the entire, you know, environment of the brain by shifting stuff. Mm. And so you have to be really aware. And I think there's training and best practices related to that. And then it's also like realizing, where do you have authority to give advice on certain things? Because if you're not a doctor, you have to be really careful and let people know, hey, I'm not a doctor. I'm making this recommendation based off of the research I've done, and here's my recommendation. But I do see it very common where people in the field of medicine will just be making all these recommendations like they're a doctor, and it's so important that they realize that that is kind of crossing a boundary.
Yeah. And also we talked about screening, but then, you know, on the other side of that is integration. And all of these medicines can be psychologically huge, not only bringing up traumas and hopefully releasing them, but really shattering, you know, the mainstream reality tunnel worldview. And I've met so many people that are just like, you know, like, oh my God. And then it's like, oh my God, like, what do you do with the, oh my God, when it changes the whole way you see reality. And then there's this longing for this sense of community and for, you know, these peak experiences, not to just be a peak experience, but to be anchored into a sense of community where we can share that feeling that we've gone through these peak experiences and we understand and have the same worldview and want to, you know, live in sustainability and abundance and move towards that. So it seems like there's a great potential in the shamanic community moving beyond just clearing trauma and healing, but in re-enchanting and reconnecting people to a sacred worldview and then hopefully helping facilitate that shift in how we live and how we love each other.
Yes, absolutely. I in order for us to get back into feeling safe, living in community, because the reason that we aren't living in community is because we all have all this trauma. And so we're always like bumping up against each other's trauma. And so, you know, we need these medicines to help us, but we also need to have structures set up where we can go and feel safe and connect with others that are like-minded or are going, you know, having similar experiences so that we can kind of process what's showing up. I think that there's sometimes points at which people get confused because they're, you know, letting go of one thing and they're stepping into something else. And in those spaces, if you do it too quickly, you can throw yourself off balance. And so I think when medicine work is useful is when it's done in a way that you can handle what's happening and process what's happening. And there are some very, there's different ways of working with medicine. There's a more yin approach to it, but there's also a very yang approach, and these, you know, heroic type yang style approaches to medicine can sometimes leave someone feeling like really empty because they got so cleaned out and they're like, okay, what do I do now? And,
well, there's definitely a few very prime candidates on the shamanic scene who are very yang in their approach to medicines. And there's some righteous criticism of that style because there can be fallout. People can be damaged, and there's still a place for that style, but there still needs to be best practices, and there needs to be a bit more of maybe a yin to the yang.
Yeah, and I do also see that the shamanic culture with the yin and the yang being said that historically it has been more of a male-dominated way of doing it. And now I'm seeing more and more, especially with 5-MeO-DMT and ayahuasca, female facilitators. And I think that's amazing because it brings in that mother nurture energy, which absolutely can come from a man, but typically the historical shamanic figure doesn't usually have that. That's not as much of an important role.
You know, I know quite a lot of Toad facilitators and 5-MeO facilitators, and I've noticed over the last 2 to 3 years that I've been in this culture, I guess if I think about it, there's a statistical, at least equity with men, but there's probably even more women I see drawn to the medicine, and I see it as like midwives. I see it as not this whole doctor shaman sort of thing, this egoic sort of centralization of where the gateway to the medicine, but especially with the 5-MeO experience, it is a death and a rebirth, and the same energy and sacredness and intimacy I would want to be present at the birth of a child is what I see that the guest or the client needs in their death and rebirth, and that women have that yin gentleness and strength within them as well to hold that space and to be midwives, but not, you know, necessarily the doctors, or they deserve that ride and that energy as well. And to give you a little story, I was in Arizona in the late summer, and I did sit with some native people there, and there was like an 85-year-old woman who did the medicine. And she did the medicine, then came out with this incredibly beautiful statement. She was like, she said that this is the time for the women to step forward, and that especially with things like the Toad medicine, it is the women who have this connection to it, who have this ability to it, and who are in, you know, reciprocal relationship with the masculine, but it's time for the masculine to learn their place and to let the women lead, to let them lead from that place of power of the yin energy, to let this interconnected network, unity consciousness come through. It doesn't, you know, and it was just a beautiful, beautiful moment to hear that from this woman who was fresh to the medicine, but really was a strong warrior in her own right.
Wow, that's beautiful. Yeah, I recently have met more women that are carrying the medicine, and I think that right now we are learning how to be nurturing. And if you remember, the Dalai Lama said, in order for our planet to survive, we all need to be like the mother, like love each other and take care of each other like the mother takes care of its child.
Yeah, that's a perfect world, Tricia.
A nurturing world. And so I think bringing in that frequency and that style is really important for the healing of humanity. And it doesn't mean it's the only thing we need. And there's, you know, there's many other beautiful ways. And I think they're all very useful. But I do really have a lot of honor and respect. And I think that the women that are choosing to step forward, just for having that bravery to do that, because, you know, a lot of times the initiations to become a facilitator, you know, were designed for a more masculine world. And so they have to truly be warriors to be able to, you know, do that. Oh, related to dosage. There's two schools of thought. One is, here's the thing about the dosage. Dosage is not related to body size or anything like that. It's related to how strong is the ego, how strong is the mind. And some people just have a really high tolerance to medicine. So when I look at dosing, I always look at, how do you respond to other things? Like if they've ever smoked cannabis, alcohol, other psychedelics. Like I'm like, how, if you've sat with ayahuasca, how many cups of ayahuasca do you usually, take in a ceremony? And from that gauge, I can say, okay, this person is either in the really low range, in the medium range, or in the high range. And the best way to really find out initially is to start with a microdose. And so just a little, handshake with the medicine to just be like, okay, what is that? What was that like? And so I give a microdose and let them tell me how it affected them. If it didn't really do much to them, I know they're probably going to be in the high range. And based on the answers of the questions, of course, that they gave me. So within that, about 50 milligrams, I know there are some people that say 100. I think that's really high. And I have seen many people, at least that I've heard from the community, that have had, traumatic situations from that level. That doesn't mean it's not a great thing. I mean, it's like if you're ready for it, it can be really a beautiful thing to do a higher dosage. So there are some people that are in the hypersensitive area where they might be in the 30 to 40. And then there's some people that are, maybe even so, afraid of the experience, because it's very common for people to be just, scared, especially their first time. And sometimes with those kind of situations, working up incrementally, like doing like a 30 milligram dose, then a 50, so on, depending on where that person's tolerance level is at. And then for someone who I call more of like a medium dose, for me is like 60 to 70 milligrams. And then first, and this is with the Bufo, the synthetic is a whole not, or the natural is a whole nother story, because that's a whole nother scale. And then for someone who is, more on the stronger side, who needs more of like what I would call a heroic dose, they could be anywhere from 80 to 100. And usually it's more like, I would say, like 80, 90 for me. I find that if you give people too much, like let's say they're someone that I would normally put in a 50 category and they take 100, then the chances are that they're gonna like what's called white out, where they just have a complete experience of white light, but they don't really remember anything. And that doesn't mean they didn't get healing from the experience. It's just I like to keep people in that perfect minimum effective dose, number one, because the medicine is rare, and I want to, be smart with what I have, because it's sacred and it's valuable. And then the other reason why is I feel like people have more to work with. When they're in that right range. And if they come back really quickly, like let's say they come back within 10 minutes instead of 20 minutes, then I will do another dose, just to make sure that they have that full release experience.
Yeah, I mean that's the thing. The ego is so strong. Even in obliteration, it can come back and reform. I've seen people so quickly, and almost want to go back to business and back to work and assimilate the white out. And I don't remember. Let's move on. It's interesting trying to figure out what the goal of the medicine is. With ayahuasca, you can sort of say, well, it's a lot slower. It works for hours. You're physically purging. It's probably, if you're surrendering to it and letting it do its work, it's bringing up stored subconscious material. But the toad's a different type of medicine. It has a different type of gift, doesn't it?
Yeah, and what I would say also is you take the medicine and your proper dosage, sometimes the person can be having that full experience and that full release, but there can be just a piece of the ego there that as it starts to come back, it doesn't feel worthy to receive it. It's like they're experiencing like the most beautiful thing in the entire planet, but the ego's like, no, I can't. And usually that's the kind of person that they'll turn around on their stomach, or they'll, you know, kind of sit up and try to, you know, fight going into the experience, or they'll want to get up and walk around. And you just have to kind of coax them to go back inwards.
Do you think this is like the stepping stones we're talking about before, that I've seen that as well, that if there's bits that you feel of the ego that aren't worthy, it's something which needs to be worked on, maybe with a different entheogen, like maybe ayahuasca and a whole session with that, looking at self-worth and looking at the issues of whatever trauma and clearing that, because Toad sort of, you know, takes you to that unity field and full source connection, but it's not necessarily working on all those buried traumas within your psyche, because the psyche is offline. So do you think that we're coming up to this point in Western-global shamanic culture? And I know Charles Shaw had some posts on Facebook a few months ago about this, of like, you know, the contraindications and the dangers of usage of different entheogens in combination, like Cambo is being used a lot now as a precursor to ayahuasca, which can be very valuable to clean people out before ayahuasca, but Cambo is very dangerous to do after Toad, but it can work before Toad, or Rape in ceremony, you know, where a lot of these indigenous cultures had their central medicine, and maybe neighboring tribes might have had another medicine, but they didn't maybe use them with the way we're using them now and in the combinations we're using them now. So we're still maybe learning right combination, right relationship, do you think?
Absolutely. What I see with combining medicines is there is, you know, one of the things, you know, that I think is really powerful is this idea of balancing the masculine and the feminine aspects within oneself. I call that sacred union. You know, some people, you know, whatever you want to call it is fine. But within that, I am seeing some facilitators where they do ayahuasca during the day, or I mean, I'm sorry, at night, and then they do San Pedro or peyote as a day ceremony. And I think that it's a very powerful tool, and I think it's useful to do that. You just have to be really careful, because if you do have someone that has a fragile system, a fragile psyche, maybe they had a past of depression, doing that level of work can throw them off balance. And so you just have to really wear kid gloves in that situation. And again, it goes back to the intake. The other piece that what I think is really important to recognize is not coming from a place of scarcity, but coming from a place of reality. There is a limited supply of some of these medicines. And I think there's a reason there's a limited supply of them, you know, because I'm sure they might even be abused if there was more.
It keeps it sacred.
It keeps it sacred. And I really believe in the importance of really sitting with a medicine, having a relationship with that medicine. And the medicine ceremony doesn't start when you take the medicine, and it doesn't end when the effects of the medicine wear off, like in your physical body. It stays with you sometimes months after. And so I feel that committing to doing a lot of medicines at one time, especially if you've never sat with just one of them, you know, or had a relationship with each of them individually, I feel like there is, you know, maybe potentially some shortchanging related to really getting everything that medicine has to give you, and really having a completion with the ceremony of sitting with that medicine. And I think that once you've gotten to the point where you've had a relationship with all those medicines and you want to do something more creative, I think that's great. I think that the medicines can really complement each other. I mean, ayahuasca is the vine and, you know, the DMT combined together, the two together are what make it, you know, amazing what it is. And, you know, there's ways of combining things like, you know, of course, with tons of safety, combining the vine with mushrooms and having a more profound mushroom experience, because they're both in the same, they're very similar in molecular structure, although different, but they're both in the tryptamine family, working on the serotonin system. And I also see that with, for instance, working with, you know, for instance, ayahuasca, and maybe doing a little 5-MeO-DMT before you do the ayahuasca, because what that can do is that can kind of clear some of the energy, so you're not spending a huge chunk of your time, you know, in that space of cleaning yourself to prepare to, you know, really yeah. get the transmissions. And then you can go into that space really clean. So that's a powerful thing. Of course, you wouldn't want to do the 5-MeO-DMT after because of the MAOI in
Well, having said that, vine. I know that ICES released a warning report a few months back that was a little bit controversial, actually, within the toad community. Because I think it was warning about, you know, MAOIs and ayahuasca in combination with toad, which is very correct, is that you should not be doing an MAO with 5-MeO because it's the most powerful entheogen on the planet to begin with, and you could go into serotonin shock or you could go into respiratory failure and you may die. And I've known people that have gone through tricky situations in that learning curve. But there's other practitioners I know of in Mexico that do sapawasca, for instance, where there is a buffer zone, a very healthy and safe buffer zone between doing, say, a nighttime ayahuasca ceremony and then doing 5-MeO the next day, when almost like what you say, it's like one is complementing the other, but it's they're working on different aspects and different things. And as long as there's that safe zone so the MAOs aren't contributing or, you know, they're not contraindicating, I think it's sort of the cutting edge, you know, not just that, but in terms of in the West, because indigenous people traditionally have had their centralized sacraments, we are the ones combining, and we need to be very, very careful, and it needs to be safe and thought through. But we seem to be the ones who are going, wow, okay, we can do that, but what happens if you do this and then do that? It's almost as if it seems to me like after a generation of predominantly ayahuasca usage in the West, if people stay in medicine culture, do you just continue to go back to the same medicine, and do you need the same medicine? Because, you know, as we say with the medicine, you take it when you're sick. And on another cultural level, there's that sense of disconnection. But if you're doing the work with the medicines and you're integrating and having time off, and then if you go back, what then? What's the goal? And is there a role for complementary entheogens to take us deeper or have deeper levels of initiations? And it can be risky business. I think we have to be very, very careful in regards to that. But it is something I see, you know, developing in shamanic culture in the West.
Yeah, I think that when you look at different cultures, they have very similar ways of doing things. For instance, the Bwiti have their own version of the sweat lodge, but it involves using hot rocks on banana leaves and then putting blankets in a hole in the ground where you're literally buried underground in a one-person temezcal, basically. So there, each culture has kind of a way of working through certain pieces and certain plants that do almost the identical thing. So if you have the wisdom within yourself to understand that, and you have a relationship with those plants enough to know, you know, if they're going to be okay mixing together, I think it's a great way to really look at, you know, each individual persons that are the most resonant with their own awakening and you know, stepping into their highest purpose, that whatever that process is. And also, I believe that in the end, we are all becoming, like, as you do this clearing work within yourself, you should naturally become more sensitive. And as you become more sensitive, at least I'm finding this with myself, and when I compare notes, you know, to other people that are doing this work, that the more sensitive you become, the less medicine you need to produce the same results. So what I see nowadays, and I think this is going to be the future of medicine and truly what the neo-shamanic culture is going to bring forth that is new and fresh, is that if you already know your path and your purpose, you're not going in there to get that information. What you're going in there for is to really micro-tune the way you are in the world, so that you are achieving those things that are your highest purpose. So it's really about self-optimization. So when you look at self-optimization, that's where tools like microdosing come into play, and that value of, like, you don't need to take an entire heroic dose of mushrooms to receive the benefits that the mushrooms have in their medicine. You can pray with them just like you would in a ceremony in the morning, and take a microdose and really set your intentions and really have them just very subtly work through your life.
Yeah, that's very beautiful. And I think that extends upon the stepping stone sort of structure we were talking about, is that it is that resensitization. And I really like this term that you've got, the sacred humans, you know, is that we used to have this sensitivity. This is what it means to be human, to be not just optimal, but to be whole, to be connected to the web of life, to be not separate from it, to be feeling and to be felt and to be, you know, in integrity with it. And it seems like that is the lesson of, you know, entheogens in general, and the resensitization and with the microdosing. But then the stepping stone eventually becomes, we realize we are the medicine and we don't need our allies and our friends in the vegetal kingdom or the animal kingdom. We claim our own power to do this and come back into the kingdom ourselves. And that seems to be the, you know, perhaps the goal we should be reaching for.
Yeah, this is it. You know, we now have access to the Garden of Eden, you know, all the sacraments that, you know, are here, the most powerful tools. And we also have new tools. You know, for instance, I've seen, you know, I have a partner and he had Lyme disease for 15 years. And the tools that have really healed the diseases of Western culture, which Lyme disease is one of those diseases, he used a combination of ozone therapy, which ozone is what the protection layer around our planet. So there's a modern technology where the blood is taken out of the body, run through a machine 10 times, and it clears out all of the viruses and all of the impurities in the blood, because the ozone kills all those, you know, like the Lyme disease and other viral things.
Yeah.
So he used that in combination with doing combo, like really high doses of combo, along with doing Iboga and 5-MeO-DMT, and that's how he healed his Lyme disease. So it's that is also part of that, is combining these new modalities in the way that we use them in modern technology to optimize these other tools together. And, like, that's our hope for humanity, because there are cases of incurable diseases that are actually, you know, being cured with these modalities being combined together.
Well, Tricia, that's a nice segue maybe for us to wrap this up and to ask you, what do you see, you know, the near-term future of shamanic culture? Where do you see it going?
Where do I see it going? Well, I feel that, we're right now in a place of conflict still as a species, where, you know, we still have a lot of our collective unconscious, or, you know, that is unresolved. And so I see, as these leaders are coming forward in the world of psychedelics and this research is coming out, that people are going to start really you know, seeking out the medicines, people that you wouldn't normally think, and people that, you know, wouldn't normally, you know, go to the jungle are going to start seeking out this work. And I see that that's going to have a huge impact on the entire planet, because a lot of these medicine ceremonies, people are receiving information, and that information is related to their highest purpose, like how they can be of service to humanity. So a lot of these innovative ideas, such as collective communities, retreat centers offering plant medicines, and new ways of doing business, such as using blockchain, cryptocurrency, to do fundraising versus using traditional banks, are going to free up a lot of space for us to create. And so this is opening a doorway for us where we get to truly manifest what we want. And part of that is a lot of people are, and I've already seen it happening, getting called to work with the medicine, but they don't really quite fully understand what that means, because, you know, they might be picking up medicines and starting to serve them, but really not have the right training, or maybe haven't really done the healing work within themselves to be able to hold that space. So I do see that there is going to be kind of a little bit of a reconciliation of more people serving. And I see also, because there is such a dire need for healing, that there is going to be a huge emergence of people, you know, switching careers, switching into the world of healing in other modalities besides just, you know, shamanic plant medicine work. So I think that there's going to be a huge, huge shift in where people's values are and the lifestyle and the creations that are coming from it, like merging technology and wellness and all these things together, I think are really beautiful. And so I'm really excited. I see it as a really positive thing. And yeah, there's definitely going to be some cleaning up we're going to have to do. But I think, you know, if we all band together and start disseminating this information, I think we'll be all right.
Beautiful. Well, that's how we get to a perfect world, Tricia. So tell me, how can listeners connect with you? What are your retreats that you run and some of the links that you may have?
So I do international retreats with Iboga, Peyote, and 5-MeO-DMT from the Sonoran Desert Toad in countries where it is legal to work with them. And I work with you know, I handpick the most, I think, integrous and talented medicine facilitators to work with alongside. And this all happens on my website. If you want more information, it's psychedelicjourneys.com.
Awesome. Tricia, thank you so much. It is honestly really such a pleasure talking with you. You are such a wise woman on the medicine path, and I really wish you well. I know that things are really blossoming for you and that your service to the community is really felt, and you're making a really big difference. So thank you for all that you do.
Thank you. And I say, you spot it, you got it, Rack.
Yeah. All right.
I love you.
Love you too. Bye-bye. Many blessings. Aloha.
Aloha. Bye-bye.